Hi, this is Hugh Cornwell, and welcome to this Mr. DeMille FM podcast. If you have any comments, suggestions, or simply want to get in touch, then please email info@mrdemillefm.com. This interview is with John Colley, screenwriter of Master and Commander and Happy Feet. He reveals a fascinating background as a doctor and novelist. I hope you enjoy the show. Well, it's with great pleasure I'd like to welcome the celebrated screenwriter, John Colley, to the interview table of Mr. DeMille FM. John, it's very nice of you to agree to be here today.
Great to see you.
And you brought along some great choices of music from some of your favourite films. Now, you've got a very interesting backstory. I mean, you grew up in Edinburgh. I think your father was a bacteriologist.
And then
India. So how on earth did you go from Edinburgh to India?
There was a bunch of them. He worked at Edinburgh University, and there was a bunch of professors who were sent out to India to help set up a medical school in Baroda. So we went there when I was 8 years old. And it's one of those things, isn't it, where at some point in your childhood you suddenly realise how big the world is and how different it can be from
what you're used to.
And so it was a really, a real moment of kind of an eye-opening moment, really, for me.
And how long did you stay there?
We were just there for a year.
Oh, right,
but it kind of instilled in my mother a lovelong life of India, and in me and my brother and sister, kind of like a fascination with travel.
Awaken something, wanderlust. So then, you started out as a doctor, right? But you were writing on the side. And you wrote two novels, and the second one got made into a movie.
Paper Mask.
With directed by Chris Moran. And starring Paul McGann and Amanda Donoghue.
That's right.
Which was a very underrated film, I think.
Yeah.
Now, how did that come about? You wrote this book, and then did the Chris Moran's production company approach you?
Yeah, he was with Granada, actually. So Granada approached me, and you know, it's fantastic as a sort of young writer to have your film optioned, and usually it goes nowhere. But I think that it was a story about a bogus doctor, and I think it somehow struck a chord. And it's a contemporary story and fairly easy to film, and they hired me to write the screenplay. And
but you've never done that before.
I'd never done it before.
So how on earth? That must have been very daunting, mustn't it?
Yeah, but you know, the structure of stories is quite a short novel, and the structure of a short novel is kind of like the structure of a film. And it was a very narrative driven novel, and so in that way, it was ideal for a movie. It was first person, which is sometimes difficult, but I knew the world really well. And so when they gave me the gig to write the film, I actually wrote it in a couple of weeks because I'd done all the dialogue and worked out all the plot already. And my agent, Norman, said, "Oh, you can't hand that in so quickly." they kind of think it was too easy. But honestly, all the work had been done beforehand.
Right.
And then we cast Paul and Amanda.
You had no help at all in writing the screenplay?
Not at that. No, I didn't, actually.
And all the dialogue came from the book, or you adapted it?
To be honest, I'd lived that life. Set in Bristol, I'd lived that life as a young hospital doctor and worked in accident departments.
So it was very
Bristol
natural
and Bath,
for
so
you
everything,
to
the whole. And yeah, that kind of the whole soundscape of a casualty department and the uncertainty of being a junior doctor and the relationships you have with nurses, that was all kind of, you know,
second nature to
you. I mean, what you find out very quickly as a junior doctor is that the nurses teach you everything you need to know. So if you can form a bond with them, then they'll keep you on the straight and narrow.
Well, I can recommend this film. It's very dark, and it's about an orderly who has a dream to become a doctor, and he assumes the identity of a dead doctor, and then all hell breaks loose. So well worth watching that. And to illustrate that, I'd like to play The Platters, The Great Pretender.
I'm the great pretender. I'm the great pretender, adrift in a world of my own. I play the game, but to my real shame, you've left me to dream all alone. Just laughing and gay like a clown. I seem to be what I'm not. You see, I'm wearing my heart like a crown.
That was the Great Pretender by the Platters from Paper Mask. Your next choice, let's go into your next choice of film music, which is Seven Brides for Seven Brothers. Now, I remember that because of my age from... it was a classic Western, musical Western.
Yeah, sure.
And now, what made you pick that?
I think just as an example of the most fabulous... simple staging. You know, I mean, there's a tendency nowadays that we can do anything in movies. You know, you can create an avalanche, an earthquake, you know, and CGI tends to then take over and in some way run the process. But there's actually a really well-staged little simple scene with a musical soundtrack. And this is just guys chopping wood. It couldn't be more basic, you know. But it's so evocative and so full of atmosphere. It's about these guys who live out way out in the woods, and they're all feeling lonely. They're all looking for love, and it's both of just a really beautiful tune, great lyrics, but the visuals that accompany it are, if you think about it, actually quite difficult to stage because they have to chop wood in time to the music. These big heavy axes that actually take quite a long time to fall, and so like you're going to time the swing.
Maybe it took a lot of takes to,
probably
to
took
take
several
it
takes.
Maybe it did. Let's take a listen to that Lonesome Polecat from Seven Brides for Seven Brothers.
True. Ooh, A man can't sleep when he sleeps with sheep. Ooh, 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 ooh. I'm a little old moon
owl.
Earliest memories of going to see movies are things like Sound of Music, you know, and they were, that is a great education because there's something about musicals. Film writing is a lot about learning the structure of films, and there's something about musicals where that is distilled to very simple narrative beats, you know, and then the big emotional moments are kind of underlined by the musical songs, you know. But once you get your head around how musicals are constructed, you've sort of got the basic toolkit for writing a story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what, can you remember the first film you ever saw?
It was Tarzan. I was taken to it as a kid by my father, and I was so distressed by it. Actually, this is weird, in that I'd kind of, even though I'd worked in emergency departments, I still find it really hard to watch violence in movies, and did then, you know. I just kind of, as a little sensitive kind of, whatever, however old I was, probably 6 or 7, I remember just leaving the cinema because I couldn't take the the carnage. I can't remember what was happening. It was probably Tarzan kidnapped by cannibals or something.
How funny. Yeah. So Paper Mask happened, and it established you as a screenwriter. And then you had big changes in your life. You moved to Australia, right?
Well,
you'd been to, no, you went to the Solomon Islands.
Yeah, what happened after Paper Mask was that that kind of gave me a profile as a writer, if you like. And then I got hired by The Observer to write a medical column. And then I was able to kind of combine medicine and writing for the next 6 or 7 years. And it was, that's a great gift, because you sort of, when you're young, the one thing you need is raw material to write about, you know? And a normal medical career is actually quite restrictive in that you choose a specialty and it narrows down into what you will finally do as a consultant or whatever. My medical career was different from that because I got this gig writing about medicine for The Observer, which enabled me to kind of travel to work in weird jobs that just took my fancy. It was kind of a dead-end street from the medical point of view. I ended up doing lots of little jobs here, there, and everywhere.
But it stopped you going down a specialist course into a little corner.
Yeah. So I was working as a kind of doctor for an oil company in Madagascar, and then working in Gabon, and then taking medical supplies to Russia. And ended up, when I met my wife, working in the Solomon Islands in the Pacific, in a little hospital on a desert island with two other guys, which is where our first child, Lauren, was born. It was a weird and strange medical profession as such, from which I retired at the age of 40. But by then I'd done quite a lot of writing. I'd written these three novels and was kind of established as a screenwriter by then. So
yeah,
it was, when we moved to Australia, where Debs came from, it was pretty easy, that transition just sort of from medicine into writing. And then I met George Miller, who was a former doctor himself, so we bonded over that. And
so Let's go into another musical choice now and see what you want to say about that. It's from Deliverance, the Dueling Banjos, a classic bit of cinema.
Yeah, isn't it? And if you watch that little clip, there's a bunch of guys who come to kind of canoe down a river in Virginia. And one of them is a very tough kind of he-man, and one of them is a sensitive guy who plays guitar, and he starts playing this little two or three chords, and it's answered by this fabulously inscrutable hillbilly kid yeah. sitting on a veranda. And the music speaks of, like, they've come into this world, I think, kind of with a very low opinion of the locals. The music that this kid, who looks sort of weird, kind of brain-damaged child sitting around, who plays this incredibly complicated music, and you realize that below this facade of simplicity is this incredibly complicated relationship with nature and with each other, which is then going to play out in the movie. So,
yeah, that's a classic sequence. So here's the Dueling Banjos from Deliverance. You mentioned meeting George Miller when you got to Australia, and I'd like to speak about your working with George a little bit later, because before you started working with George, you actually worked with Peter Weir.
Well, correct? Actually, I started working with George before Peter Weir.
Oh, okay.
Happy Feet took so long to make, because George was sort of pushing the boundaries of what was possible in animation at that time. he'd seen David Attenborough's sort of life in the freezer, and he wanted to make an animation that was as realistic as that. And it was kind of not technically possible without a kind of room full of computer equipment, you know. So
that project started before.
Started before, and it finally came out in 2006. But I think we started it in 1997. It was a long, long process. By the time it came out, I'd sort of moved on from that. George was then, because you write an animation script, and then it becomes. And the great thing about animation is it's very plastic. You know, you write the script, and then you can start animating in very simple form, and then playing the movie and improvising on it with the actors, you know, and adding bits and taking bits away and trying out songs. And so that whole process was going on without me while I then went off, wrote Master and Commander with Peter. And I came back to Happy Feet right at the end when they'd sort of assembled a kind of a rough cut and did a final pass on the script, and that was the one that we
got it. And how did you end up meeting George? How did you end up meeting him?
So the first film I wrote in Australia was a film about an Aboriginal freedom fighter, and the producer of that, Tim White, who's a great friend now, sort of was asked by George, you know, any decent screenwriters, and Tim very kindly recommended me. So we met at a cafe, actually, not far from here, where we're doing the interview, and George sits down. He's an incredibly engaging, high-energy guy, and he starts pitching me this story about sort of penguins in the style of Busby Barclay. And I'm thinking, anybody other than George Miller, I would say completely bonkers. But obviously, you know, we sort of... we started working it then, and George assembled a, because he's a very serious-minded person, he kind of assembled this fabulous team of advisors who were kind of Arctic experts and penguin experts and anthropologists. And we did a long period of research. And then, as often happens with film, you take all of this information and you distill it down into a story. Yeah.
So, well, as we're talking about Happy Feet, let's play some music from that. It's got a great soundtrack,
it does.
It's fantastic. I've picked Tell Me Something Good by Pink.
Okay.
And it's actually a Stevie Wonder song, right? But it's this version from Pink is the one in the film, and this is it.
Refuse to put anything before your pride.
Let's go to your next movie choice, music from movies, which is The Long Goodbye, which is the Elliot Gould film.
Yeah, yeah.
Very
fantastic.
Underrated film.
Yeah.
I love it. I love it. So tell me why you've picked this.
So I just thought Robert Altman's idea in this, which was to take one song and use it throughout the film in different forms. So you have a Mexican mariachi band playing it in Mexico. You have a... You have a kind of hotel crooner singing it in a hotel lift. You have a bar pianist playing it in a CDLA piano bar, and the music becomes incredibly familiar during the course of the film, and it takes on all these different shapes and atmospheres depending on where he takes you in the movie.
Yeah.
It's a really great film. It's, you know, I always think films have a kind of a hidden meaning, that actually your job as a writer is to sort of take some thematic sort of secret and implant it in a story. And ideally, the theme of the film is so well disguised that it's not immediately apparent until you've watched the film a couple of times and it comes home to you. And there's a lot in this film which is about the way that male violence towards each other is finally becomes expressed towards women, and this, so this guy goes on a hunt initially to protect his friend who we think may have killed his wife, and when he discovers the truth, I won't spoil the plot for you, but when he discovers the truth of things, I mean, being through these various meetings and relationships, it's a gumshoe story adapted from Raymond Chandler, he finally ends up killing the friend, and justice is finally exacted on the person who it should have been all along.
Mm. Are you a fan of Chandler's writing?
I'm more of a fan of Robert Altman, who I think is a genius. Yeah, yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
Good.
Yeah, and I grew up with Chandler. In fact, that was my when I said, you know, sort of my film education was musicals. My literary education, I think, was these sort of male action writers, you know, like Chandler, Steinbeck, Graham Greene, Ernest Hemingway, you know.
Mm. Yeah. Great. That's a great body of work there. So let's take a listen to Jack Sheldon singing The Long Goodbye.
Happens every day when some passerby invites your eye to come her way. Even as she smiles a quick hello, you let her go, you let the moment fly. Too late you turn your head, you know you said the long goodbye. Can you recognize the theme? On some other street, two people meet as in a dream, running for a plane through the rain. If the heart is quicker than the eye, they could be lovers until they die. Try when a missed hello becomes a long hello. Recognize the theme. On some other street, two people meet as in a dream, running for a plane through the rain. If the heart is quicker than the eye, they could be lovers until they die. It's too late to try. When a missed hello becomes a long goodbye. Don't you try to be nice to me now. I'm leaving and it's goodbye. I ain't running after you in the rain when you're catching a plane. No more. Goodbye, goodbye, goodbye. I'm through this time and I mean it. In fact, I don't know if I ever even did like you, except for your body. Your body was good.
So, you've told me about your meeting with George Miller and you and the genesis of Happy Feet. Now, could you tell me how Master and Commander came about, directed by Peter Weir?
Yeah, so Peter and I had the same agent. And I think it's funny how the thing that you do in life that seems completely like a wrong decision can sometimes turn out to be a right decision. So having met and fallen in love with Debs, I came to live in Australia. And at the time, it seemed, you're going to the far side of the world and, there's no film industry there in the way that there is in Los Angeles or London. But what was great for me was there were all these fantastic directors and not terribly many writers because with a fairly small population, Australia didn't have a terribly mature television industry. And that's where most writers learn their craft, you know. So I found then that I was kind of able to work with these incredibly celebrated directors who would actually come and ask me if I would sort of collaborate with them. So with Peter, it came through our mutual agents and I went up to see him in his beautiful house up the coast from Sydney. And we agreed to work on these Patrick O'Brien books and we worked in the... He had a little wooden house next door to where he lived, which was this flimsy construction among trees that would sort of sway with the wind. So it was sort of like being on a boat. And I would drive up. It was about a bit over an hour to drive from my place to Peter's, but I'd listen to all the O'Brien books as talking books in the car on the way up. And then we'd discuss the plot and how to put this thing together. And quite early in the process, my wife Deb said, "Oh, you've got to listen to this Yo-Yo Ma cello, Bach cello piece that I've been listening to, because it really reminds me of a boat." And so we'd play music often when we were talking and discussing the plot. Mm. And this cello piece became one of our themes and ended up in the film. But Peter always used to say that his aim as a film writer was to create film with the emotional immediacy of music, which I think is something that he does incredibly well. But you know how a song can immediately evoke a very specific emotion, you know? And that's the trick with film, is that you can get beyond your conscious mind into the unconscious emotional response.
Interesting. Well, let's... could we play the Thomas Tallis piece?
Sure.
Fantasia on a Theme, Vaughan Williams.
Yeah.
Very well known from Master and Commander, The Far Side of the World.
Thank you.
And that was from Master and Commander, Fantasia on a Theme, Thomas Tallis, by Vaughan Williams. So now that was, that really stamped you on the map of screenwriting, and the film won a lot of awards.
Yeah.
And obviously you've got a great feeling of satisfaction from that, I bet. And then what happened? Did suddenly the phone, you know, wouldn't stop ringing, and what happened then?
Oh, look, it's all swings and roundabouts in the film industry, isn't it? And I think one of the things then that you have to learn as a film writer or in any artistic profession is to not be too distracted by the big money, flashy offers, and actually to focus on who you are and what you do best, you know, so...
Projects that suit you.
Yeah, exactly. And that, weirdly, that becomes more difficult the more successful you become, you know, and so...
What, because there's more to choose from, or...?
Because there's more to choose from, and the doorbell is always ringing, and there's always this... there's always things that sound exciting. But also because, I guess, you know... I once said to Brian Brown, who's an Australian actor, tell me about your career, and he said, mate, I haven't had a career, I've had a life. And that's sort of how I feel about my film writing career, is that, you know, one step forwards, two steps back, and... you discover all the ways in which great projects could fall over, and really unlikely projects
can blossom.
Yeah, and among those, I mean, recently I worked with a couple of documentary making friends on a little film shot in Vanuatu called Tana, which went on to be nominated for a Best Foreign Language Oscar. You know, this was like. We went off to an island off the coast of Australia and made it for $20,000 initially, you know, with like two guys who'd never made a film before, and me and this tribe of people who didn't speak English, and it was and it became a great success.
That's funny.
Yeah,
that's great. But that's great. That there's the unexpected.
And it's always like that, isn't it?
Makes it all fun.
Yeah,
doesn't it?
Yeah.
Let's move on to another choice on your list, which is the barn building sequence from Witness.
Yeah, sure.
Tell me something about this.
So this was, this was a film of Peter's that I'd seen many years before I met him, Peter Weir's. And I use it in a film writing course that I teach because it seems when you first see this sequence, just like a wonderful, it's beautifully lyrical music, and you're being shown this Amish community and they're building a barn. It seems at first glance like it's just a kind of a little restful interlude in the story about Harrison Ford and this witness protection in the Amish community. Actually, what's happening in that film is every single beat is about a relationship of Harrison with the woman who he's falling in love with, Harrison with her most likely suitor in the community, the anxiety of both her father and her auntie about whether this relationship is going to blossom and what that then means for Harrison Ford's involvement and his relationship with the kid. The whole thing is done in little sort of beats and glances, hardly a word of dialogue, and the music and the action of building the barn. His incorporation into the community is represented by the barn. And there's this wonderful undertone of the problems that that's going to cause them all.
So let's hear the music by Maurice Jarre.
Thank you.
next one on the list here that you've brought along is the Michael Nyman's music, the theme from The Piano.
Yeah.
Could you tell me something about that choice?
This is a stunningly good film, isn't it? And it's kind of, it's one of these films, there's not many of them, where the soundtrack, where you sort of can't imagine the film without that particular soundtrack.
Mm.
I think I read about Michael Nyman being presented with the narrative kind of concept of the film about this Scottish woman who is sent as a kind of postal bride to the wilds of New Zealand, who has, through some trauma that's never explained, she's decided not to talk, and she communicates with her piano. The piano in the film, films work in a kind of in a sort of dream language, and the piano comes to represent her sexuality, which is the thing that Sam Neill can't cope with, but Harvey Keitel is prepared to invest time and labor in. You know, so when Harvey Keitel says, "I'll bring the piano up from the beach if you teach me how to play it," that's kind of redolent with kind of meaning. It's only afterwards, when you're thinking about that, but why did that work so well, that you realize it's all about a partner who brings to the relationship this inconvenient thing, you know, female sexuality, that the men are kind of overwhelmed by and don't quite know how to handle, and one of them is prepared to incorporate it and to learn it rather than dismiss it as an inconvenience. Yeah. Anyway, Nyman's music for that,
beautiful,
incorporates a whole lot of tropes of Scottish folk music, which obviously very dear to me. And but it's also, she's a classical, self-trained classical pianist, and I think he's trying to imagine, if you came from Scotland and you didn't have any formal musical education, what would the music that you produced be like? And so it's got echoes of Scottish folk tunes, but it's really about wind in the trees and the movement of the sea. And it's in that respect, it's so evocative. And it expresses, which is absolutely appropriate to the film, it expresses this natural, overwhelming power that people can't get a grip on because it's so unpredictable.
Thank you. That was the theme from the piano written by Michael Nyman. I'd like to ask about your working relationship with John Amiel, because you worked on Creation with him. Tell me something about... you've known John a long time?
I've known him for ages. And in fact, when Paper Mask was first mooted, the two people who came to me to say, can we buy the film rights, were Granada on behalf of Christopher Morahan and another London producer on behalf of John Amiel, who'd just made The Singing Detective, which was a work of genius. And the weird way that this business works, Granada had the money and the other producer had just this brilliant director who I immediately bonded with. But being new to the industry, I kind of didn't quite understand that relationships are what it's all about, you know. And so in a funny way, I think I made the wrong choice there and went with the safe choice of Christopher Morahan and Granada. But that friendship with John lasted then ever after. So it continued, and John went on to make an amazing career. But finally, we finally got to work again together, like 30 years later, on Creation, which then brought in Paul Bettany, who I'd known from Master and Commander. And in fact, a lot of the Paul Bettany character in Master and Commander was inspired by the later adventures of Charles Darwin. And Paul then brought his wife, Jennifer Connelly, with him to play Mrs. Darwin. And that was just a wonderful, happy experience, that movie, yeah.
And it brought you... And, of course, it's about Charles Darwin's life.
And it's about the life of Charles Darwin.
So it brought in your sort of medical sort of background as well.
And the great the British producer, Jeremy Thomas, who's a national treasure, who kind of put it all together.
Yeah, excellent. So let's hear... Christopher Young's Suite from Creation.
I should actually say at the end of that, that was kind of my homage to Michael Nyman and the piano, because, I mean, in a way, Darwin and his wife have this fundamental disagreement, which he sees the world through a scientific lens and she sees it through a kind of a religious lens. And the way they communicate is the emotional language of her piano playing. which was always a sort of central concept of the movie, you know, that Jennifer would play the piano, and when she was really cross with him or really just anxious about stuff, or that the music would... And she was actually, in real life, Darwin's wife was a pupil of Chopin's.
Wow.
So, but the music filtering up to his office would express her feelings about what was going on in the family.
Yeah. Great, excellent. And the next choice, Before Sunrise, the record booth sequence.
Yeah.
Tell me something about that.
Oh, this is so great, this movie, isn't it? It was sort of a... there are probably antecedents to this film, but I didn't know of them. And the idea was to do a love story, to play it all out in a single day. It's just two people walking around a town talking, you know. So I guess there's a famous movie called My Dinner with Andre, which is just a conversation in a restaurant. What's particularly brilliant about Before Sunrise and the two films that they made subsequently, which I can't remember the names of, Before Midnight and After Midnight. All three films operate on this idea of a single relationship and a conversation that goes on all day, but it's beautifully kind of modulated in that you're constantly being surprised by who they are and what their backstories are. And that is what drives the plot, that we, along with the central characters, are getting closer and closer to the heart of these people. And along the way, obstacles to why this might not work and then encouragements to why it might work.
Mm.
In this particular scene, she's playing him a song in a record booth, and they've been kind of skirting around the whole idea of, is this potentially a sexual relationship, or is it a friendship? You know, will it last? Is it just going to be over?
Mm.
And she plays him this very erotic song, and they're standing right next to each other in a record booth, and the film is completely played off their glances
to each other. Part
of the great appeal of filmmaking, I think, is that you're asked to read characters' thoughts.
Mm.
So, which is why dialogue that is too direct never works. You kind of are always looking for what are they meaning with that look, what are they meaning with that gesture. You know, when you get great actors and a really good director, and in this case, a fantastic piece of music, but also a bunch of weird questions and responses that are just expressed with a turn of the head.
Yeah.
So it's absolutely magic.
No, I'm not.
And that was Kath Bloom singing Come Here from the film Before Sunrise. The next thing you've got here is an echo of your time in India, I guess. You've picked Jai Ho, is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah,
from
yeah.
Slumdog Millionaire. Yeah.
I met Danny Boyle, the director of this fabulous film, when we were both at the Toronto Film Festival. It was actually when Creation came out, and the pair of us ended up teaching Toronto film students for 4 days, and we were allowed to bring in anyone we knew who was in the festival to talk at this thing and discuss movies. So it was just a fantastic experience, and he's such a wonderful, playful guy who... I was talking earlier about learning to trust your instincts. I think he's always had that he makes these weird offbeat chances that are offbeat decisions of what to work on, which are seemingly counterintuitive but actually brilliant, you know. So deciding most recently not to do a James Bond movie, which seems like a no-brainer, and deciding instead to do a story about an Indian guy who invents the Beatles is actually a genius idea. And I remember coming out of Slumdog and thinking it was one of the most immersive and moving film experiences I'd had for some time. You know, it really stands out as a great... And that wasn't just because of my long affection for India. It was it was just a brilliantly well-written, well-crafted, well-made, and significant movie. You know, I talked earlier about the way that movies have hidden themes, and this came out around about the time of the global financial crisis, and it's about the fact that your life experience is your wealth. You know, when everyone is telling you that money is what is going to make a difference in the world, actually what is going to make a difference is your life experience. And that thematically is what it's about. As I thought, Dev absolutely nailed it with the performance, and he and I have since become great pals. And so we've just we're just in the middle. In fact, we just finished writing a film which Dev will direct himself, called Monkey Man, about a
great
underworld wrestler in Mumbai. And he's we've just released Hotel Mumbai, in which he plays the lead.
From Slumdog Millionaire, let's hear Jai Ho.
Jai Ho, 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 Jai Ho,
So tell me about Hopscotch Productions, which you set up a few years ago, right?
Yeah. So Troy Lum, who's a distributor, and Andrew Mason, who produced The Matrix in Australia, and I set up a film company 3 years ago. It was certainly a learning curve. Screen Australia generously gave us the money to develop a few films. We made. A number of movies, including The Water Diviner, written by a great Aussie writer, Andrew Knight. I talked earlier about the way that, you know, television writing is the training ground for most filmwriters, and Andrew was sort of the doyen of TV film writing, TV writing in Australia for many years. Anyway, so he came to us with this great story about Gallipoli. He's actually married to a Turkish woman, so it was very close to his heart. Russell came on board to Russell Crowe came on board to act and direct in it, and so that was kind of a bit of a high water mark for us at Hopscotch. I think Andrew and I have since moved on. We're now going to, because Troy is really the business brains of that, and so Troy is now sort of looking after Hopscotch Features, and Andrew and I will continue to contribute as kind of freelancers, I think, to that. But that's where Hopscotch is now. I think Troy's got three or four really wonderful projects in motion. And Andrew's always on tap to produce, and I'm the kind of script fix guy who can come in and help them along. Yeah.
And the essence of it is to have it all homegrown Australian.
Yeah, sure. And there's a couple of companies that have come out since we started, including Emil Sherman's Seesaw, which made The King's Speech. And so there's actually quite a renaissance of great Australian filmmaking.
Great.
Now, yeah.
That's good. Yeah. That's good to hear. And have you got anything coming in the future that you want to tell us about?
Well, what I'm working on just now with an Australian director, Phil Noyce, who made the fabulous Dead Calm. Phil's mother and father met one night before Phil's dad went off to basic training in Palestine in the Second World War. And his dad then fought through the awful siege of Tobruk and remained in communication all through this with Phil's mum by a series of letters, which Phil still has. And so that love story is what sustained Phil's dad all through this horrendous battle, which ended up lasting for 8 months, and during which 12 of the 30 men in his section were killed, and he was the lone survivor. And he came back home and married Philly, his lover, the day he came back, well, 4 days after he came back. That idea of this little strand of love, based on one meeting, they basically met before he left and they got married when he came back. Yeah. The idea that a kind of, if a love story is sufficiently strong, can sustain you through the worst that life can throw at you, I think was really strong. So Phil and I are working on that just now, and hopefully that's getting pretty close to.
Great. Sounds very good. It's been fantastic, you agreeing to this. You're the first screenwriter I've had on the Mr. Nimel FM, which is great. And it's very nice of you to agree to talk to me. And it's been fascinating hearing about your experiences in the film world and as a screenwriter. And I'd like to finish up with your last choice, which is one of my favourite movies, from Life Aquatic of Steve Zissou. And it's Life on Mars by Su Jorge. Is that how you pronounce it?
I think so. Su Jorge.
Tell me something about this choice.
Oh, look, this film, I think...
So funny.
So funny. It so nails the kind of heroism and tenacity of men like you and me at a certain point in their careers, you know, where we kind of, I mean, we know the world belongs to the younger generation. We know that, you know, and I think part of growing up is accepting that, you know. But Steve Zissou in this movie is such a great invention. He's this kind of fantasist who won't quite let go of former glory, and he's still, and it's, and And most of what he does is bullshit, but occasionally by accident he strikes it.
Yes, that's right.
Notes of brilliance, and that's kind of that's kind of our experience of life, isn't it?
So it sums it all up, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Excellent. Yeah. Well, John Colley, thank you very much for this very interesting chat. And let's sign off with Life on Mars by Su Yorga from Life Aquatic of Steve Zissou.
Quando as coisas do coração não consegue compreender e a mente não faz questão e nem tem forças para obedecer, quantos sonhos já destruí e deixei escapar das mãos. Se o futuro assim permitir, não pretendo viver em vão. Meu amor, não estamos sós, tem um mundo a esperar por nós. No infinito do céu azul, pode ter vida em Marte. Então vem cá, me dá a sua língua. Então vem, eu quero abraçar você. Seu poder vem do sol, minha medida. Então vem, vamos viver a vida. Então vem, senão eu vou perder quem sou. Vou querer me mudar para uma life on Mars. Não faz questão, nem tem forças pra obedecer. Quantos sonhos já destruí e deixei escapar das mãos. Se o futuro assim permitir, não pretendo viver em vão. Meu amor, não estamos sós, tem um mundo a esperar por nós. O infinito do céu azul, pode ter vida em Marte. Então vem cá, me dá a sua língua. Então vem, senão vou querer quem sou. Meu poder vem do sol, minha medida. Então vem, vamos viver a vida. Meu bem, senão eu vou perder quem sou. Oh, 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 vou querer me mudar para uma life on Mars.